Accession number 17626, Mr. Thomas Lawton, reel 12.
Mr. Lawton, reel 12. So you'd gone to the citadel at Arras, where you were with other prisoners of war, and then you'd been given this task of going for the bread.
Yes.
And was this a German truck?
Oh, yes.
You're now with tank column. What happened next?
Right. When we got in that little crew, which they thought was for soup, it wasn't a work party, we were pushed onto a German truck, taken away to this warehouse, we loaded up with German war bread, and as we were coming back to Arras, we saw these columns of armour moving very quick, and Jack Tingle said, they're on the run. I said, on the run? He says, yes. We didn't know about that counterattack which was being delivered somewhere about the 20th, that's why I said the 19th, about the 20th or the 21st of May was when the attack was made. We found ourselves in the German columns, moving at high speed, running away from the British. And I thought, isn't this remarkable? When I was a lad, I was always dreaming about running away from the Romans. Somewhere, Senlac Hill or somewhere. I'd been running away for nearly 6 or 8 days from the Germans. Now I was with the Germans running away from the English. And I thought, that's marvellous. Anyhow, in a short space of time, Stuka planes came across, swooped across the column, and they, as far as that's concerned, they stopped the whole movement. Jack Tingle and I scrambled away from that truck in a commotion, and we got across a field, and a British armoured car picked us up. These had been people with the column, and when that column got stopped, they had just scattered anyway. And Jack and me were picked up, and we finished up about 2 miles off the beaches of Dunkirk, joined a defence perimeter. I can nearly think of the name, the canal. I was surprised the number of canals. There was a canal that way and a canal this way, and that was the Van Dyke Canal or something like that. And we were facing, that's where we were, with the defence around Dunkirk, and we didn't know what was happening in Dunkirk.
Were you able to convince the armoured car officer that you were English, because you're still
in your civvies?
Well,
civvies. And it was then that we disposed of the civvies, not in the armoured car, but when we got back with the troops, we disposed of the civvies, and we wore a uniform, but I didn't have any badge of rank or anything like that, just uniform. And that's when we were on this defensive line about 2 miles from Dunkirk, as the Germans had closed the pits. We were supposed to be slowing down the pincer movement.
Did you know which regiment you were with?
No, it wasn't any regiment. It was just all clothes. Everything. Including Queen Victoria Rifles. Never forget them. Queen Victoria Rifles. And I believe they wore like black badges, something like a rifle company in the Durhams at one time, the 6th Battalion. They were black buttons. And these lads had practically arrived in Calais into the hands of the Germans when they moved out. And I only remember they said they were a motorcycle battalion, but they didn't have their motorcycles with them. They were rushed to Calais, and the Germans were practically occupying Calais at that point. But it was just a conglomeration of all kinds of troops there. Hard to tell if there was any command of any kind, but we were there, obviously, to hold up the German advance, which we either did or we didn't. And it was from there that we started out to be prisoners of war.
Do you recall how you were actually finally made the prisoner of war?
Simple as anything. We knew that the Germans were there. But just in the same manner as we knew that the Germans were hundreds of miles away in France, they weren't there. They were here. And when I mentioned these canals, I know there was two canals. The foot went in different directions. Now, one faced one wind, the other was faced this one. And while we were lying there, the Germans had obviously come round behind, and we just became prisoners of war. There wasn't any fighting. There wasn't anything like that. There had been. We didn't really know why we were there. We didn't know what was happening on the beaches 2 miles away. But we knew that things were pretty bad because we were all just clustered together. And as far as I'm concerned, the Germans must have known we were there. They just moved on behind. And what they did to us was what they were trying to do to the BAF, fasten them up against the sea.
There's just one point really to settle in the story now. You recall you told me that at Lillet, you were caught up with a German on a motorcycle, or on a horse, and you were walking was riding. You must have got away from him again there, did you?
No, why? He took us to a school. And in that school, there were very more prisoners of war. And because I was just like a Frenchman, that's where I said to them, bonjour. And of course, they gave me a mouthful. And then we were all taken away from there on the march, and we went into a tennis court. And that night it rained very heavy. And I was walking around inside that tennis court in the early hours of the morning, and I heard somebody go, psst, psst. And when I looked, there's a young German sentry, and he waved me across to him, and he gave me a bar of Cadbury's chocolate. And he said to me, you will be going to Berlin. I am going to London. And in 2 weeks' time, I'll be walking down the Adolf Hitler Platz in London with an English Fraulein. And I said to him, where is the Adolf Hitler Platz in London? He says, what you call Piccadilly Circus. They had it all planned, what they were going to do. Of course, you never did. And from that place, next day was the first time we were interrogated by a German officer, and we knew name, rank, that's it. And the man said himself, look, you can save yourself as all a lot of trouble. I know what regiments you belong to. I know where you've come from. We know all about you. And he was telling us about the 11th Battalion. You were there, you were here. And it was a waste of time trying not to tell him because he had it all on paper. And at that point, we were going to be marched out, and that's when we went towards that field. He says, there was an English major there. He would not march in front of that mob. It was such a mob, he wouldn't march in front of it. I don't know what happened to him. But we were marched for many miles, with a wagon in front of us, with a machine gun pointing at us along the roads into that big field.
And that's where we're caught up with that. That's cleared that up nicely. Right, so you were made prisoners of war. Mm. What, you don't remember the date on which this happened?
No, I do know this. It was 6 weeks after that when I was registered as a prisoner. But that must have been, for instance, the evacuation finished when? Around the 4th of June or so, was it?
2nd or 3rd of June, that kind of time.
Right. Well, you see, it was about the 16th of June or the 20th of June before I was made signed on the books. In other words, for at least 3 weeks to 4 weeks after that, we were marched through northern France in never-ending circles, round and round, into Belgium, up into Luxembourg.
Can we examine your memory on that march?
Yes.
Yeah, you were taken prisoner on this particular day.
Just outside of Dunkirk.
What happened to you then? What did they do to you then?
We just rounded up. As I have said, the humility of a defeated army and the degradation of being rounded up like cattle and herded through France in never-ending circles was most demoralizing.
This must have been a pretty harsh blow to you personally.
This is very hard. And we were passing places which we'd seen days before. And then we would pass them again. Because what we didn't realise, the German Luftwaffe was driving the refugees and everybody into certain areas so as to block any advance by the British or the Allies. And it was on those marches where I realised the nastiness of the Germans. Some villages you went into, we were ragged, we were hungry, we were desperate. When they said halt, we just halted and dropped down more or less and slept on the grass. All right, aufstehen, and away again. Some of the village, the women had got together and had a little water point and maybe some bread. And the Germans kicked the lot over. All we were getting was a handful of what could be dog biscuits, if we were lucky. And as we went further on into bed, I wondered and I worried, I hope we don't get into Brussels. I've got relatives in Brussels, and I would hate for any of them to have seen me as a prisoner of war. And after the war, we learned a great deal. My sister and my nieces, they said a lot of British Tommies came through as prisoners of war, and we were always looking for Uncle Tom. But Uncle Tom didn't get there.
On this march you were talking about, where did you stop and sleep?
Just anywhere, at any time. The thing was, the most horrible thing that was happening was our boots. Through the wet and damp grass and through the heat and the hot weather, the boots were beginning to crinkle and they were digging into our heels. There was no possibility of taking them off, because if ever we'd taken them off, we'd never got them on again. So we limped a long way. But there was no idea of how long you'd be on the march. The water would come, halt, and wherever you were, you just stopped. You dropped. On one occasion, in a town, and I don't know where the town was, there was a woman given food away out of a basket. And I knelt on my knees and prayed for something for her. And when I got it, it was an Oxo cube. And I always did say, well, there's one thing. It was a square meal.
How often did they feed you on the march?
They didn't. I never remember any food, soup out like that on that march. They just kept pushing on. And, all right, so there's a house there. Take a risk. I've done it. I went in and eat the Frenchman's dinner. Pushed him out the road. Now it's dinner. Right? The Germans did not in any way look after us. They just kept pushing us. After all, the machine gun, the refugees, and if they do that with the refugees, and in so much that it was a country that had the slogan, guns before butter, we couldn't expect to get much of them.
There was no march discipline.
The discipline, yes, we had armed guards right along the side of us. If you had dropped out, you'd probably just get shot. See? The biggest menace to us were the French, because they had walked out of the barracks with full packs, plenty grub and everything, and every time he saw a Frenchman, he was squatting, doing eating and the other thing at the same time. And they never seemed to make any effort. But it was wrong on our part to condemn them, because later on, just outside Dunkirk, they were really fighting to hold the Germans back while our men were being evacuated. Of course, that's what comes after the war when you read about it.
So all of your toiletry situation was just dropped by the side of the road?
Just drop where you are and do it. And use the grass, because there's no paper, no note. And this was right through prisoner of war. Never was there a piece of toilet paper anywhere, and our latrines were usually just 14 foot deep trenches with barks across, because you used to say we're sitting like hens on the bark. But on the march, no, nothing.
Were the guards front line men, or were they now second line?
No front line men, and they were good. First time I ever saw a Tommy gun. Two guards had them, and they were on bicycles. And they were saying, come on, what about Tipperary? You know? And they were pushing the French out the road. They said, get out the road, let some soldiers come by. The Germans appreciate that, you see. And you've got to hand it to them. They were soldiers. They were vicious. They were cruel, as we found out when we got to Poland. But on the march, no discipline other than keep moving. And you couldn't get away because of the guards on the side, armed guards, who would have shot just like that, because that was their duty. I remember diving into a garden and taking some rhubarb off two young women. The guards were sending. They knew we had to eat. And after the war, I had Delors, I think it was Delors. After the war, I wrote to the mayor of Delors, or whatever he was, and said, I want to apologize for stealing some rhubarb off two young women when I was passing through as a prisoner of war. Of course, I never got an answer back. So this continued. March, halt, march, halt.
And the weather, you say, was hot, warm?
Oh, aye. We were very fortunate that way. We had some lovely weather, but we got rain also, and this was the rain that damped things down, because once you got wet, you were lying on wet grass. And the Germans on the march had a habit of stopping you if they saw men with tattoos on. And they wanted those men to be photographed with tattoos on. And another little trick they had, the cameramen were there. Anyone like a cigarette? Put your hand up. On the Wacken show, British prisoners of war, given the high Hitler. They did all that kind of thing. They were, I don't know, they were stupid in a way, but they were very wily in other ways. But they did not in any way help any of us on the march. It wasn't a march, it was a push. And we went through France, Belgium, into Luxembourg. On Luxembourg, they put us onto open cattle trucks, open wagons, and we were taken by train into Trier, probably the oldest city in Germany. And there, we were marched round on exhibition to holiday-making Germans. They were all in holiday mood. And I never saw a hungry-looking German or a badly-dressed German, even at that period of the war.
What response were these onlookers to you as you marched round?
Just scoffing and laughing. Never spitting. But Polish women spat at us. But these Germans know. Swastikas, Trier, swastikas, three-story high hanging. Bands playing. People eating ice cream. And yeah, these are the Englishmen. You want to say we were lousy, we were dirty, we were scruffy, we were hungry, we were sick, we were tired. And the march was round Trier. And then the march was down to Trier station, and they pushed onto cattle trucks, 70 to 90 on a truck, so much so that we couldn't move. One loaf of war bread for a man, and a water container, which most of us never saw. And they never let us off those trucks, not even for the laws of nature, for 3.5 to 4 days over Germany into Poland to a place called Schubin. And anything we wanted to do, we did it where we crouched or stood. In other words, we were covered with excreta in a very short space of time. And the heat inside those trucks was terrific. And we sweltered. We were sidetracked. We were shunted right away across Germany into Poland and never allowed once off those trucks.
Some men must have broken down with it.
Some men did break down. An old man called Taffy, he was a pioneer corps, Taffy Evans, came from Wales, and I looked at that man and I said, Taffy, how old are you? And he said, I think it's about 61. Eh? I said, right, I've got a little bit fat there. Now this old man, Taffy Evans, he looked an old man. He had actually been taken prisoner of war in Calais, in the caves in Calais, where he'd been with the Pioneer Corps. And he said he was 61. I said to him, well, look, Taffy, there's not much we can do, but if we ever have anything to spare, we'll give it to you. And the same old man finished up in a camp where I was, and he always said that I got him home because I put him into what they called the Revere. It was only a room with two or three beds in, and it was a sick bay. And when the Germans saw him in there, they treated him for sick, and he was repatriated. And I got a letter from the Ronda. My wife got one before I got back. And I've got it somewhere there. Harry, if I ever found it, you never knew such a man as me, because Taffy and me held thousands of Germans back when the lads got home. And I always remember him saying in the camp, you know, my wife, she'd be saying there, fancy that now, he's been taken a prisoner of war. I wonder if he'll die. Because you see, Taffy says, she'll want me pension. All this kind of thing. But Taffy got home. Whenever I got a little bit extra something, I give it to Taffy. The Germans came once in a camp we were in. By the way, we've finished this journey.
Yes, can we just finish the journey before we go any further? You've talked about the pretty truck. Horrendous conditions
yes.
you were in. Was there any system within the truck itself to kind of move people around
no,
so they got more
you
air?
Couldn't move.
Too tight to move?
Too tight to move. No, these trucks, they were bolted, barbed wire across, and at the end of each truck there was like a ventilator. It would be an aperture about maybe 12 inches by 24 inches, but it was barbed wire across. Nevertheless, we could look out of it with a bit luck. If you were near there, you get some fresh air. And we stopped in a station, and they said, oh, you want to see this? There was the most beautiful woman standing on the rear of a train, and all the high top rank of the Nazis were there, clicking their heels and saluting her. And alongside her train was our train of full of stinking, dirty prisoners of war, and she must have known them there, but she never found them. They moved away again, and eventually somebody said, hey, we're in Poland. Where? Poland. How do you know? He said the name Poznan, spelt Poznan. Well, I said, you're fucking wooden Poland. And after 3.5 days, that's all it was. Shunted, sidetracked, and didn't matter where you stopped, if you could get a look out the window, there was some interest. First time we saw a party of slave workers, elderly women, beautifully dressed in white aprons, black hats, and behind them a Deutscher, a Hitler Deutscher, or Hitler Mensch, not Mensch, Fraulein, Hitler Fraulein, in uniform with a whip. And somebody says, look, she'll flog them with that whip, you know, when they get to work. We couldn't believe it. But the more we saw of it, as we got towards Poland, the more we realized, and especially when we became prisoners of war. But eventually we arrived at a place called Shubin, a hell camp. Shubin.
Did it have a number?
Eh?
Did the camp have
a
number?
No. See, it wasn't a camp. It was a transit point. And as we approached that, we were passing little Polish hovels, and the Poles said, you know, spitting at me. It was bloody funny. And on one occasion, we saw a young woman running across the floor with a kiddie hanging onto her dunes and a jerry behind her belter. There was an old woman. She smiled at us. And there was a big German policeman. He was a policeman. He hit her so hard in the stomach, he must have smashed her back. We couldn't believe it. And when we arrived in this place, it had been an agricultural college. There were poles hanging by the thumbs in the trees. What they called latrines, these deep trenches, There was limbs in there going rotten. We couldn't believe it. And we learned that the reason why these poles were spitting at us was because they'd been told to do so by the Germans. And that was our first introduction to German bestiality. And I saw a man with a red beard on and red hair and a stupid German French hat and a little Polish uniform dishing soup out. You see, where it said B-R-O-T, bread, I thought it meant broth, brot. Oh. And when I got up to that man, I could have cried. He was R.S.M. Sullivan of the 2nd Battalion, or the 1st Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry. And he was standing there like a scarecrow, ladling soup out into the doors. And when I got there, I spoke to him. He looked at me as if to say, I should know him what I'm doing. I told him who I was. I said, I admire your uniform. Yes, well, he says, we all tried. He'd get into civvies and he'd get this old uniform. We all tried. Goddard, RSM Goddard, a lovely man. And he was at the depot at Newcastle.
But and was this the first meal you got when you got off the train, that he was labelling this soup?
Oh,
out?
Aye.
The camp itself, now, what did it look like? The transit area you were going into?
It wasn't a camp. It was just a big a conglomeration of buildings and poles, all poles, some with arms, some without arms, some with legs. Definitely in bad condition. And the only thing was that when we went in, we were more or less kept by ourselves. But you see, the commandant of that place hated the British. And so at night time, although you were just lying in a big barn, he would have you all out on parade and make you do deep knee bends while another one with a stick went round, and you try to dodge it, get up there. And he told us we will soon be in Paris and then we will soon be in England. He didn't tell us what to expect, but we knew from what we've seen happen to the poles. So we were in there 2 or 3 days, and then we were taken out.
Did they at this point clean you up and feed
you?
No. Still in the condition that you were in?
No. You see, there was nothing like that. There was no care of any kind. You went in, if you were lucky, you might get a loaf of bread in that big queue. If you didn't, that's it. You went in, and you didn't know whether you're going to move out next morning or next month. All you knew was, Aufstehen, marschieren, halt. And we were there 3 or 4 days. Then we were taken out.
When you got, some of you, as you say, did get some bread, some didn't. Was there any sharing amongst you?
Oh, no.
That was yours and you hung on to it.
You see, it's difficult. See, in that place, there was no issue of anything. It just happened, there's a table there, and I give him bread, and we get into it. And that happened all the time, until he got settled in a camp where it was kind of organized. But from there, we went into another place, which was worse. The commandant in that place really hated the English. And he let you know he hated the English. And it's really difficult to keep track of it. I can say I was in at least 18 different camps. And I met 18 different kinds of people over the period of time. But the remarkable thing was to think that in such a short space of time, from Provence, we went through all that experience and a month had hardly passed. See?